Hello, everybody. Daniel Gregory. We're here with Aaron Bretthorst on the Perceptive Photographer this week for Interview Month, and I'm really excited to have him join me. He's one of my favorite photographers and a really interesting person, and I'm super excited that he was willing to join us today. So why don't you go ahead and say hi to everybody, Aaron?
Hello, everyone. Longtime listener, first-time interviewee. I'm excited to be here.
Great. Yeah, I think we're going to have a lot of fun today. Talk about a lot of, I think, hopefully interesting things. One of the first questions I have is, why photography? Like, what is it about photography that kind of got you interested?
You know, Daniel, I was thinking about this earlier today. I was actually on my way over to meet with you. I was listening to an episode of your podcast where you were talking about what got you into photography in the first place. And you know, similarly, I was never involved in yearbook or the school newspaper or anything like that. I had my first experience in a dark room at the age of 15 in my high school. But then I set down the camera and I didn't pick it up again until probably, 20 years later. No, I'm sorry, 10 years later, excuse me. I lose decades sometimes.
We all do.
And what got me into it at first was just a desire to pick up a hobby that got me out from behind my computer. And little did I know at the time that a digital camera was not going to be something that was going to get me out from behind my computer as much as I wanted to be. But that said, what kept me in photography, what has kept me in photography over the last 10 years since I first picked up a digital SLR, has been the ability that it gives me, increasingly so as I've focused on the craft, to tell stories, to try or to have the tools to express to others what it is that I care about and what I'm passionate about and why they should potentially hear me out in a visual context.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because I think that's one of the hallmarks in, one of the things I think about the difference between, somebody who is a snap photographer versus somebody who's dedicated to the craft or the art of photography. And I think that storytelling element becomes an important aspect. So it's not just about the capture of a moment or a memory, but it's an extension of that to a kind of a universalness versus just becoming my own story. It's a way to find a story that can resonate with others. And I think that is one of the things that differentiates people, I think, who are dedicated to that craft more so than somebody who just takes the occasional picture or snaps pictures when they're on vacation or something.
Certainly. I mean, that said, I don't want that to be seen as a denigration of people who see photography as a way of sharing a particularly beautiful sunset or what they had for dinner or anything else. I personally believe that a desire to visually express yourself to other people, regardless of the underlying motivation, is incredibly important. And it really makes me happy to see how many people have embraced that, how many people take photographs on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's one of the things when you go back and look at the history of photography, that democratization that the camera gave us to empower everybody to have something to share. Mm-hmm. People weren't confined to only the elite wealth, only the really wealthy people being able to afford painters to come in and do portraiture. Everybody had access to that. And you're absolutely right. I think having people share that is important because it's an important part of what they see and recognize in the world from that element. Now, you mentioned being from behind the computer and you're a software developer by trade.
I am.
Developing all that. How does that, do you think, influence your photography in that what, I come from a tech background as well, and that there's a certain methodology, a certain level of quality, there's a certain process to actually writing software. How does that influence your photography? Or does it?
No, I think it definitely does, and I would like to think that for lack of a better way of describing it, almost say like the sort of anal retentive precision that I have to apply to my software development sometimes comes through in the photographs that I make. I think in some cases that can be helpful, and in other cases that can be detrimental. It certainly influences how I try to structure my compositions. I think that my appreciation for software architecture also, as it works out, comes through as an appreciation for the photography of physical architecture. I love strong lines. I love graphic elements. But to jump up sort of a level and get back to what we were talking about just a second ago, another way that my software engineering background has influenced my photography is in terms of the kinds of projects, the kinds of storytelling ideas that I come up with. Like, for example, right now I'm starting to flesh out a project that will involve sort of melding together historical photographs of just Seattle at first, just my neighborhood, Capitol Hill, along with more modern photographs through apps for iPhone and Android that users will be able to use to visualize classic scenes of a particular space. So trying to put this into more concrete terms, you'd download the app for free from the App Store, and you'd open it up, and it would show you a historical photo of a scene. You'd hold it up in front of that scene and be able to visualize like the old buildings that used to be there before they were torn down for another set of townhouses or whatever.
Interesting.
And that's a concept that I don't think would have even occurred to me had it not been for, you know, the fact that I make software day in and day out. And when I'm not making software, I'm making photographs.
So I think one of the things that's interesting about you as a photographer and my experience working with you is you do have a number of, I think, really interesting projects that come up. And you mentioned this kind of insight from the old neighborhood and the gentrification of the architecture and the community that's kind of changing the way Seattle is. How do you come up with your project ideas? How do you come up with the ideas for what you're going to create? Is it something like this where it's a blending of one element of your life with another, or is it inspired from something else you might see or read about? Where do your project ideas come from?
You know, I really wish I knew. I think that if I had a better sense of the answer to that, it would be a more reproducible process and I would be able to come up with new project ideas, you know, faster and more easily than I do today.
Do you think it would kill the magic?
No, I don't think so. I think on the contrary, it would allow me to focus on the craft as opposed to the ideation. And that would allow me to maybe even move faster on these things instead of spinning my wheels for, you know, days or weeks or months at a time, trying to come up with like, you know, the perfect idea.
But that's the creative process.
Yeah. True. Oh, so I mean, from that perspective, yeah, it would kill the creative process, but I think for the better.
Yeah, I'd get more work done.
Yeah. The first photography project that I created that was personally meaningful to me came out of a class I had with you, actually, a couple of years ago. It was the Photography 3 class at Photographic Center Northwest. And when I came into that class, so it's a project-centric class. You spend 10 weeks, correct me if I get your syllabus wrong here.
Yeah.
You spend 10 weeks focusing on a single photography project, envisioning it, refining that concept, and then executing on it.
And a lot of that class, too, is about learning how to articulate and talk about the project and where it actually came from and how you could speak about it to others. But yeah, that's a good representation of the class.
And you know, when I came into it, I had a very, very different project in mind than what I exited with 2.5 months later. I wanted to do some work around macro photography. And when I started working on that for your class, actually, like I discovered that it didn't resonate with me in any way, shape, or form. Like I didn't feel connected to the work I was doing. And I might have been able to produce something that at least looked visually interesting, but it wouldn't have mattered to me. And so I spent a week or two noodling around with this idea of like, what is it about a photograph that makes it meaningful to me? And in the end, I flipped that around and asked, what is it about a photograph that makes it meaningful to other people? And so I ended up asking, you know, 10 or 12 friends of mine, like, which photograph of yours has been most personally meaningful to you? And more importantly, perhaps, can you try to explain why? And then I photographed them with their photographs, and that was the project. That was a transformational experience for me, I think is the best way to describe it. It made me realize that the value of a photograph to me is likely to be different than the value of a given photograph to another person, and that those experiences that we have with these images, no matter what that image is, as long as it's personally important to us, is valid.
And do you think that shifted what your concept of storytelling was before?
Absolutely.
Then?
Yeah. I realized at that point that I didn't have to, you know, lug an 8x10 view camera out to the Tetons and try to pretend to be Ansel Adams. I could just be me, and that's just as good.
Yeah, and I think that's a seminal point in a lot of people's creative process, is the moment they realize that who they are and the value they're adding is as significant as everybody they've ever studied or come into contact with. Mm-hmm. And it's a hard thing for people to get to, because there is a imitation quality, and then there is the struggle of, well, how is my own voice important? Mm-hmm. And I think society, it's one of the things where I think artists, it's important for people to be artists, and it's important for artists to survive, especially given our current political situation, which Absolutely. We'll talk about with you in a second, because I know mm-hmm. it's a passion of yours right now. Each one of those stories matters, and that uniqueness matters, and that telling of that story matters, and that artists are in some ways condemned to put that in the forefront and mm-hmm. to really struggle through with that. And I think you're absolutely right. And when we don't make that corner and we don't make that turn, I think we struggle not knowing why. And it's because we're in the imitation game rather than the be ourselves game. Mm-hmm. You know, in that process, you talked about looking at the macro work and not really not resonating. Mm-hmm. How do you go about critiquing your own work?
It can be hard. I mean, I like to say that I am my own harshest critic, but that's not necessarily true all the time. I find it can be really easy for me to lull myself into a sense of complacency, or thinking that the work that I'm making is, you know, great or meaningful or whatever. I find that it can be really helpful to just get a reality check on that by, you know, tossing stuff out there, no matter how close to done or not that I think it is. And that could be, you know, putting it up on a website like Flickr or 500px or Instagram or even Facebook, or sharing with friends and family and asking them not, do you like this, but instead, tell me everything you hate about this. And I try to do that same thing. Like, instead of focusing on the positives, in some cases I will focus relentlessly on the negatives. And as soon as I get to a point with my work where I can say, I don't hate this anymore, I think I'm onto something.
And then from the point of not hating it anymore, mm-hmm. how do you know when it's done?
I don't know if any of these are ever done, to be honest with you. I will set down projects temporarily all the time and pick up other ones, either new ones or ones that I've been working on off and on for years. I recently just started photographing reflections in buildings again, just in the last couple of weeks. And this was something that I was really into a few years ago, and sat down just because I was bored with it, or I'd run out of things to say. And I found a new voice just recently, and I wanted to start speaking to that again, I guess. A project is... Actually, you know, I think software might be a good analogy for that. Like, software is never truly done. You can have a version of software be finished. You can release it to the world, and in fact, you have to. The value of a piece of software is in its utility. And I don't want to make a utilitarian argument Right. for photography, but the value of a piece of art, the value of a photographic print is in its visualization and interpretation by others. And unless you can allow that to happen, unless you can allow it to you know, get out there into the world, I put that in air quotes, it won't have a chance to really be appreciated. So don't worry about it not being done. Worry about it being in a state that is sufficiently coherent that other people can derive some value from it.
I think that's great advice, because I think I know sometimes even in my own work, and I look at work of other people, that notion of there's a quality bar or a statement bar that has to be achieved mm-hmm. that will actually never be achieved because of our own psychology around mm-hmm. that. I like that approach of, you know, getting it out there, and there's always that refinement. There's always that chance to come mm-hmm. back and reinvestigate. And I think that goes to when you look at a lot of photo books, whether you look at Uncommon Places by Shore. I mean, he even went back and re-added images into that book on a re-edition. So there's always a chance to kind of come back and reshape and recraft. I mean, in Ansel God, if you look at his early printing and his later printing in life, those are not even close to the same photographs.
Oh, absolutely. Like, especially Moonrise Hernandez. Like, the differences, you know, no pun intended, are just so stark between the first prints of that and the last ones.
Yeah, absolutely.
They really are just different photographs altogether.
Absolutely. So I think one of the things also I've seen in a lot of your photography is a sense of experimentation. Mm-hmm. You're not caught up in a very, you know, one technique or a one type of camera. How important is that experimentation process for you and ultimately getting to that final vision of that photograph when it's ready to be released?
You know, one thing I really like about your podcast, I'll come back to your question in a second. One thing I really like about your podcast is how opposed to gear acquisition syndrome you are. You never talk about gear. You never talk about the latest Leica whatever or the Nikon D umpty ump with it.
You remember that when I ask you what gear you're currently using.
However many megapixels it has. And it's hard for me because I'm a tech dork and I love new toys. I really do. But at the same time, like having the latest and greatest camera with the most megapixels or the most finely resolving optics is never going to allow me to create a great photo. It might help in some capacity, but it's not going to be the determining factor. Back to your question though, experimentation, different cameras, different techniques. I really enjoy the differences in compositional technique and differences in speed that I can get moving between iPhones or mirrorless digital cameras or medium format film cameras or even large format film cameras. And I love having the opportunity to allow the tool that I'm working with to shape the work that I produce. I think that for any given scene, regardless of the camera you have with you, again, whether it's an iPhone or a 4x5 large format camera, you can create meaningful work in any situation. If you can't find, you know, one amazing photograph within a block of your house, you're just not looking hard enough. And it doesn't matter if you're using an old janky camera or a new great one. So finally, let me see if I can answer your question. I really enjoy the limitations that are placed upon me by the gear that I'm using. And I love responding to those limitations that are placed upon me and trying to make them part of the work itself. This might be best explained given an example. So the reflections work that I was talking about that I started a few years ago and sat down. The way that originally came about was I'd been working in Columbia Center, which is the tallest building west of the Mississippi River. It's certainly the tallest building in Seattle. And on the top floor of the building, there's this beautiful observation deck. And it's, as you might expect, it's absolutely, you know, packed with people during the summer. They have amazing, like, wraparound 360 views of the Olympic Mountains and the Cascades and Mount Rainier. And
in the wintertime, you get to see gray fog.
Oh, yeah. No, it's absolutely beautiful. You know, I mean, like, I love calibrating my zone
exactly,
5s through
yeah.
that. It's great. And I always got really frustrated when I was up there because of the wraparound views, you'd always get these really nasty reflections. Like, the sun would be shining through and, you know, you'd get these, like, glare spots in your images. And so you'd have to make sure you'd bring a lens hood with so you could press your camera right up against the glass panes. Press it right up against the glass windows so that you could, you know, like, not get reflections. And finally, I thought to myself, you know what, like, I'm thinking too hard about this. I should really embrace the limitations of what I have in front of me and see how I can make something interesting out of that. And that led to work that I thought was much more interesting than what I've been producing before. And by the same token, like, I think really thinking about what your camera brings to a given situation and what its limitations are and how you can best engage your camera's limitations to make more interesting artwork will be beneficial both for your craft and your learning and your end product.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember the first time I was torching through $6 sheets of 8x10 mm-hmm. film because the trees kept moving, and it finally dawned on me, like, why don't you photograph the wind? yeah, stop fighting the resistance and just kind of follow the path of least resistance, and the work takes care of itself. I mean, that's the cool part about art is the work always ends up taking care of itself. Who were some of your early photographic influences? Like who, like you mentioned, you know, not wanting to haul the 8x10 out to the Tetons.
Sure.
So, but you know, who are your, you know, especially given the fact that you shoot color, you shoot black and white, you print in historical processes, you know, really who are some of your significant influences?
You know, I mean, like just like for everyone else, I mean, Ansel Adams is certainly an influence in some ways. As I've learned more about the history of photography, that has become, you know, he's become less of an influence overall, or at least just less of an overriding one, just because there are so many amazing photographers, both well-known and not. You know, like Gordon Parks has been a major inspiration to me. He was a, I was going to use the word legendary. I hate the word legendary. He was a very notable civil rights photographer who did just these absolutely beautiful color photos of the segregated South, and also a fascinating sort of like visual representation of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. And his work certainly has inspired my notions of how many different forms photographic storytelling can take. And Alex Soth, a Magnum photographer from my hometown, in Minneapolis, is up there as well for me. He did this amazing series of photographs entitled Sleeping by the Mississippi in the early 2000s that are, in some ways, these really simple portraits of normal everyday people up and down the banks of the Mississippi River from Minnesota to Mississippi. But they have this amazing depth and vitality that really just, you know, speaks to my soul.
Yeah, there's an interesting, I think, element to both those people. But for, you know, Alex to shoot with an 8x10 camera, you know, 15, 20 minutes to get those portraits set up. And it definitely shows his connection he was able to make with those people as he got them to patiently wait for that moment to actually happen. Yeah,
absolutely.
And his work from Niagara Falls is pretty interesting as well.
Yeah, and I'm a huge fan of his latest photo book project, which was called Songbook as well. In my opinion, really broke the mold on what was expected out of, you know, an Alex Soth photograph. Instead of his, you know, massive 8x10 camera, it looks like he switched over to a digital camera and just shot these fill flashed digital photos that were converted to black and white. And they're so weird. There's these amazing surreal photographs, but it speaks again to, like, you know, it's not the camera that makes the image. It's the person.
Yeah. And like, the foresight to recognize that he needed to do something different to tell the story he wanted to tell. It actually did require a different look, a different camera, a different setup. And rather than try to shoehorn it into, well, this is what I do. You know, following the path of this is what I need.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I think is interesting.
I mean, even Ansel Adams shot color film on occasion with a 35mm camera.
Yeah. It looks like a black and white photographer shooting color film. But
true, but...
but no, I mean, and you know, and a lot of those people, you know, they made, you know, Ansel made a career as a commercial photographer and as an architectural photographer. And there's a lot of those sides we never see of those different people, which is interesting to come back into. We've touched on this a little bit. But if you had to pick one thing that drove your creative process, you mentioned storytelling. Is that really at the central essence of that? Or is there something else that drives your creative process?
It is an insatiable need to engage in self-expression, which typically manifests itself as storytelling. But I wake up in the morning and I am driven to create day in and day out. And it honestly sometimes is really exhausting, but I feel happier and more fulfilled when I have the opportunity to make new things.
You can't fight what you are. If you're a creative person, it's got to ooze out of you. And even if you think you're a sculptor and you end up doing something else creative wise, the creativity can't not be fulfilled.
And you know, I mean, like I'm sure that you've run into occasions where you feel like you're stuck in a rut, or you've run out of creative energy or whatever. And you know, I experience that all the time too. And I've found on those occasions, one of the best things that I can possibly do to break myself out of that is to always just go back to the basics, you know, like start doing a 365 project again, which I've successfully done once, and I think was probably one of the best things I've done for just improving my you know, technical acumen with photography, just getting out and shooting every single day, or finding one really sort of, you know, oddball subject to photograph. Yeah. Maybe like cracks in the sidewalk. If you don't feel inspired, go shoot cracks in the sidewalk until you feel inspired again.
Yeah. One of the things my partner Lori and I oftentimes talk about too is the living a creative life. Like if I don't feel like picking up the camera, but I pick up a photo book mm-hmm. or I watch a movie that's inspirational, that mm-hmm. those all actually count in the bucket of mm-hmm. work. And it's just a weird psychology because I think we're so conditioned to 40-hour or 60-hour work week. You put in a certain amount of things, you do a certain amount of expectation. But in the creative space, there's a lot of different elements that swirl in that on what mm-hmm. ultimately defines that creative process.
I agree.
Which is interesting. So one of the things that if somebody follows you on social media these days, I would say one of the things that you're active with would be politic.
You could say that, yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. you seem to have a certain current passion for driving that forward. And why is that critical to you as a person who's an artist, mm-hmm. given the shift towards the open conservativeness and some of the things that have come up post-Trump's election? Mm-hmm. Why is that important for you to speak out the way you do around those issues?
You know, I'm really lucky on just about every axis you can consider. I'm white, I'm American, I was born in the United States. I was born into a middle class family that had a strong expectation that I would go to college and I would get a college degree. I'm straight, I'm male. I happen to luck into like having a talent and passion for one of the most lucrative career paths available, you know, at the first part of the 21st century. I recognize that like it really is just dumb luck that all these things conspired to make me, you know, like give me these advantages in life. And I recognize that these are not all opportunities or advantages that are afforded to everyone. Opportunities that I'm afforded are in some respects unique to the natural characteristics, the genetic lottery that I just sort of, you know, lucked into. And I don't feel that that's fair. Just because you're, you know, you have a different color of skin or you want to be married to someone else, a person of a different gender, or you feel that the gender identity that you were assigned at birth is not really who you are, that doesn't mean you're any less of a person or that you shouldn't be afforded every opportunity in life. I'm still trying to figure out exactly how my art and my politics come together. I haven't quite sorted that out yet. That's kind of my
follow-up or my mm-hmm. bigger question is it seems that that's become so strong as a compass, directional compass for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you imagine that in developing your art? Do you think it'll change what you photograph? Do you think it'll change the type of stories you tell? Or is it you're still sort of knocked back on your heels a little bit and you know what'll influence it, but you're just not sure how yet?
I have to imagine that it will influence it in some way. It might take a year or two. You know, like I've certainly noodled around with different concepts for projects, nothing that is well-formed enough to even be able to express in words at this point. But you know, like work that has really resonated with me that I think speaks to the climate we find ourselves in today is work like Richard Rinaldi's series of photographs of strangers touching. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the name of that offhand?
Touching Strangers.
There you go. Okay. Convenient. You know, that's for those of you who haven't seen it. I highly recommend looking it up. And B, it's just these photographs of complete strangers like physically connecting with each other. And it sounds perhaps kind of silly or maybe even sentimental, but you know, spend some time looking at these images and try to put yourself into the shoes of either of the people depicted in the images and think about what they were thinking. There seems to be such a divide in our country. today. And I think that that divide has certainly been there for a very long time. What we've seen in the last year or two is honestly nothing new. The particularly virulent strain of nationalism that has reared its head in America has been around, you know, arguably since the early part of the 19th century or even earlier. But I think it is incumbent upon everyone who believes that America stands for fairness and equality and equal opportunity, regardless of how you worship or who you worship or who you are or what you look like, it is incumbent upon everyone to ensure that the actions we take and the ways that we express ourselves in the world advance this notion of fairness and equality for every American.
Yeah, and I think there's an interesting element from a art standpoint where art often allows us to broach a subject in a way that we don't necessarily want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a togetherness that probably exists in this country that is stronger than it's been. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we're dealing with an element that's on a, I think probably more on a fringe than it is in the center, but it's got the megaphone right now. Mm-hmm. And I do think that as we find ways to show, I love the statement of Richard Rinaldi's, you know, if we find ways for us to connect in meaningful ways and to show how we're alike and how mm-hmm. we stand together, no matter who we are, I think that's an interesting opportunity. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how and what kind of art gets shaped coming forward. Mm-hmm. Because I think the other thing that will happen is the minorities, whether you're African-American or from the LGBTQ community, you know, that art will have a more impactful way, because mm-hmm. one of the things that I think happened to white upper class liberal males is they realized, like, oh, wait a minute, this is what everybody's been dealing with. Oh, mm-hmm. And so that awareness is in the forefront. And I think there's a really interesting opportunity for a huge segment of artists who haven't had the exposure, who have been dealing with these same issues for an entire lifetime mm-hmm. to bring that work into the forefront. I think will be really interesting for all of us. In that education moving forward.
I completely agree. I would love to see, you know, expansive bodies of work come out of communities devastated by opiates.
Yeah.
And like I feel like that in particular is such a cross-cutting concern. You know, just a couple of days ago in my super trendy Seattle neighborhood, like I almost stepped on a needle just sitting on the sidewalk. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, clear across the country in like, you know, rural Ohio, there are, you know, literally thousands of people, if not more, who are suffering from opiate addiction today.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely, I think,
it's terrible. A
consistency across all of us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, the right art, the right artist mm-hmm. stepping forward to tell that story.
Sure.
Or journalist, mm-hmm. whoever does it, to tell that story, I think offers an interesting opportunity for all of us to really mm-hmm. understand the gravity of what's actually going on versus being just isolated in our mm-hmm. homes, wherever they are.
Yeah.
When you're creating work, you know, we've talked a little bit about how you know when it works, when it's ready to put out in the world. Mm-hmm. But what kind of fears do you, what kind of sits behind your head, and what are your demons that you face on a regular basis in trying to create work?
I am constantly terrified that I'm going to be outed as the fraud that I know I am. That my work is going to be revealed as being, you know, inelegant or inadequate or, you know, sentimental or fuzzy or just not very good.
And then how do you get past that? Do you just work through it? Do you beat it with a club? I mean, what's your
I just sort of suck it up and say I have to put this out there anyways. I can't just sit on my work in perpetuity, because even if all of these things are true, the only way that it will ever get better is if people tell me that.
Yeah.
And I have the opportunity to grow my work.
Yeah, I think you read that. At the end of the day, that's no matter what the fear is, mm-hmm. the answer is you kind of on some level got to suck it up. Mm-hmm. Like you got to put it out there. You got to deal with the fear. And most of the time it's unjustified, unfounded anyway, which makes you then have to deal with the fact that you've been afraid of this thing that's not true anyway.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like, I was talking a little bit earlier about how I like to ask people to evaluate my artwork, by asking them to tell me what they hate about it as opposed to what they like about it. And I find in some respects that's sort of a useful rhetorical trick for me, at least in terms of putting my work out into the world, is by saying, here you go. Honestly, I think this sucks. There's lots and lots of problems with it, but hopefully you'll find at least one thing redeeming in it.
Yeah, it's a defense mechanism.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it works well for me, and hopefully it works well for other people as well.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that'd be interesting there too is, if rather than hate, maybe what doesn't work for you in the work. In some ways, I think worse in the art world is work that's loved and work that's hated at least is getting primal emotional response. But what are you indifferent about? So when you look at the work, you know, what's indifferent about it? Because if somebody comes back to me and says, I'm indifferent about the work, I know I got a problem. Because I haven't been able to piss them off. And I'm pretty good at pissing people off. So on that level, I always think, man, that's going to be a problem. A couple of quick things. So what's your favorite movie?
Blade Runner.
That's a good one.
Yeah. The color palette that Ridley Scott used in it, the locations that he shot in, the basic questions it raises about what does it mean to be human.
Well, and the prophetic nature of the rise of corporations and control. And yeah,
absolutely.
Favorite book?
Oh, that's a lot harder. My favorite book, at least that I have read in the last couple of years, is, to your point about, drawing a response out of people, whether it's love or hate, has to be Susan Sontag's On Photography.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many things about that book that drive me insane. Like, I consistently want to throw it across the room every time I read it. But, you know, after I pick it up again and, like, you know, unbruise the pages a little bit, like, I discover that there is, like, a really profound message in there.
Yeah. No, she, you know, particularly not being a photographer, had some very accurate insights into photography that I think photographers at the time and today weren't really ready to hear. Yeah, and some of the stuff, I think she's still a little crazy, but I'm aging. I'm getting smarter with time. So yeah, every time I revisit that book, I'm in the same boat, something different. Favorite TV show?
I don't really watch TV. Currently, though, if I had to choose something that I've been binging on, is The Great British Bake Off, and I'm.
That's a good bake.
I am very sad to say that I'm almost done with the seventh series, which is going to be the last one, at least in its current form.
Yeah, no, I'm blushing to say that is also one of my absolute favorites.
It inspired me to take a stab at making French macarons for the first time. I'm really not a baker.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know what, like I've watched these people make them on several occasions, and clearly they're really, really fiddly, but at the same time, like, I seem to have a knack for dealing with really fiddly things. Yeah. And I made them, and they were actually pretty tasty. They looked terrible. But, you know,
did you get a pan?
No, I drew out little circles on parchment paper and nice. I piped it.
Yeah, I got so addicted to making those, I actually went and bought a macaroon pan.
Nice.
Favorite travel destination?
Ooh, again, a tough one. I love Hawaii. Hawaii is shockingly easy to get to from Seattle. There are several direct flights a day that go from Seattle to the Big Island and Maui and Honolulu. And it's always nice to know that there's like a tropical island you can get to without having to get a visa first that costs, you know, $500 to get to.
Yeah.
But you know, from a more exotic perspective, I'm in love with Tokyo, you know, like Blade Runner is my favorite movie and Tokyo has to be my favorite city.
All right. Biggest photo regret.
Biggest photo regret.
Yeah.
It's probably all the times that I've seen the perfect photograph and I didn't have my camera with me.
It's hard to take pictures when you don't have that camera.
I mean, on the plus side of things, I do have, you know, like the, you know, my mind's eye capture of that, but it's just not the same in the end. There's, you know, all of these things that I've seen that I want to share with other people, much like, you know, in fact, much like Roy and Blade Runner and,
Roy.
God, my mind's somewhere else today.
Yeah, Roy Beatty.
Thank you. You know, like the only thing I can do is just, you know, try to make sure that I have the right camera with me or a sufficient camera with me.
All right. Speaking of cameras, I promised I would give you a little time. So mm-hmm. what's your little gear? What's your latest little camera of love?
A friend of mine asked me a couple months ago how I was liking my Fuji X-T1 after having used it for the better part of 2 years. And I told him I loved it. I thought it was a fantastic camera and I highly recommended that he get one himself. And he actually asked if he could buy mine. I hadn't thought about upgrading my camera. The Fuji X-T1 is great and fulfilled all of my needs, but at the same time, the Fuji X-Pro 2 is really just a thing of beauty. I love rangefinder cameras, and the Fuji X-Pro 2 is one of the most ridiculous examples of one I've ever seen. It's not like Leica ridiculous, but it's, you know, it's pretty ridiculous in a wonderful sort of way.
Third the price and makes really nice photographs.
Exactly. And so, you know, in the end, I agreed to sell him my X-T1 and my battery grip because I wasn't going to be able to use it with any other camera, and picked up an X-Pro 2 from Adorama while they were doing a sale a few months ago, last winter. And at the end of 2016. I love my X-Pro 2. I don't actually have it with me today, though. I've been lugging around my
X-100.
Actually, I do have that with me today, along with my Hasselblad 501cm. Which is a beautiful, wonderful, relatively speaking, quite gainly camera.
Okay. And for those of you who are digital, that would be an old film camera. So,
it's not that old. It's only 27 years old. 27
years. But you don't have to go look up on the internet. We'll just let you know. You have not missed a new camera from Hasselblad. It's an old film camera.
Or DJI now, I suppose.
I guess DJI is. Well, they're little drones flying around with Hasselblads on them. So if you had a piece of advice you could give a person just starting out in photography, what would it be?
Make images every single day. Think about the images that you want to make. Think about the images that you have made. Think about how you can make your images better and look at as many images and words about images from other photographers as you possibly can. I feel like the photography community has a bad tendency to gaze at its own navel in a lot of cases. And anything that a budding photographer can do to avoid that, to keep trying to push their craft forward, is going to make the work that they produce so much better.
Great. And along those lines, and I haven't had a rant on this in a while, but I normally am not a big fan of the notion of we're creating timeless photography today because you can't tell it's timeless till its time has passed. But if you were going to pick out a photograph for you that really is iconic, like what is like the kind of the essence of your iconic photograph in your memory when you think about photography, you know, what would be that one image for you that would be truly timeless and iconic?
Oh, man. You know, given the sort of historical precipice that I'm afraid we might be on today, what really sticks out for me right now are two images from the Vietnam War, the Napalm Girl photograph and then Saigon Execution, as being really timeless. Right. Examples of how utterly barbaric we can be.
Yeah, and I think also those are great indicators too of the power of the photograph to create its own story independent of what actually happened in the photograph, and that we have created. And I mean, they're hallmark photographs that on some level caused the shift in cultural society in the U.S. towards Vietnam. And the facts that were portrayed about those photographs weren't entirely accurate at the time. And so, yeah, no, those are very interesting selections in that regard, because they were very foundational in how we thought about our actions in the Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
So if people were going to find you online who are interested in your work, how would they go about doing that? Where are you located these days?
My portfolio is available at AaronBrethorstPhotography.com. That is only infrequently updated. I post daily work on Instagram under the name Aaron Bredhorst, and also on Flickr under the name Aaron Bredhorst. You can also find me on Twitter and most other social media websites under the same name. I always use my own name for everything.
Great. I'll go ahead and have links to all that in the show notes so you can easily find that kind of stuff. Well, Aaron, I really appreciate you taking some time to sit down today and talk a little about photography and your kind of interest and background and all of that. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll do it again in the future.
And thank you. It's been really a pleasure having the opportunity to participate in this.
Great. Thanks. And well, don't forget, you can always find us up on iTunes or you can find us on the web at www.theperceptivephotographer.com. And thanks again for tuning into the website. You're in the middle of interview month. We'll have a couple more interviews here coming up over the next couple of weeks. And I will see you next week.